From the Cumberland Gap to the Atlantic Ocean, this is Virginia Water Radio for the week of November 1st, 2010. I'm Alan Raflow with the Virginia Water Resources Research Center. This week on the Hoping to Swat the Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets campus of Virginia Tech. Our news section this week is extended by several minutes to focus on stormwater, currently one of the biggest newsmaking water issues. After a brief introduction to stormwater, we'll provide sound clips from talks at the Water Center's October 21st Symposium on Stormwater Technology, Policy, and Regulatory Developments. Stormwater is rainfall or snowmelt that doesn't seep into the ground and therefore flows over land into natural surface waters or into storm sewer systems that eventually lead to natural waters. In developed areas, buildings, roads, and parking lots increase the area of impervious surface, that is, surface into which water can't infiltrate, and this leads to increased stormwater runoff. High and rapid stormwater flows can erode natural stream channels and cause downstream flooding, and stormwater can carry oils, pet waste, excess fertilizers, and other polluting substances into waterways. The first sound clip from the Water Center Symposium is from Jennifer Malloy, the Stormwater Coordinator for the U.S. EPA's Chesapeake Bay Program Office, who discussed stormwater management trends, policies, and priorities. In the following excerpt, she describes one of the key findings of a 2008 National Research Council study on stormwater.
First of all, the NPDES program, and that's how we've been regulating stormwater since the early 90s, is really all about pollutant concentrations, right? It's about effluent limits and permits and things like that. And we chase those pollutants, pollutant by pollutant, with numeric effluent limits. And I think what the stormwater study pointed out, and I think those of us in the field kind of already knew it anyway, is that it just doesn't work very well for stormwater. Stormwater has so many different pollutant constituents in it, and really the bigger deal is water volume. As already mentioned, it's those higher volumes of more erosive velocities and things like that that cause a lot of problems. And so what the study pointed out, and I think quite appropriately, is that if we're going to manage stormwater effectively, we have to start managing water volume.
The next comment is from Lee Hill, the Assistant Division Director for Stormwater Management Programs at the Virginia Department of Conservation and Recreation, who summarized work to revise Virginia's stormwater regulations. In this excerpt, he emphasizes that stormwater management is a statewide responsibility.
How many know the importance of January 29, 2005? Anybody? January 29, 2005 is when the Virginia Soil and Water Conservation Board and the Department of Conservation and Recreation became responsible for MS4 and construction general permitting. This was the consolidation in House Bill 1177, where it brought in all stormwater into one board and one agency. Also on January 29, 2005, and this is the one a lot of people do not understand and still do not understand today, is that stormwater management for water quantity and water quality became statewide on that date. Within the last 6 months, we've had several engineering firms tell us they didn't know that. I can't believe that with all the advertising we've had, all the projects we've reviewed, all the conferences that I've given talks at and other folks have talked to, all the supervisors, board of supervisors we talked to, that there's still folks out there that do not understand that as of January 29, 2005, water quantity and quality have become a standard statewide.
The symposium's third speaker was Lisa Oxenhurt, an attorney with Aqua Law in Richmond, who discussed local government perspectives on stormwater management. No sound clip from Ms. Oxenhurt's talk is available, but she emphasized that local water management will be affected significantly by two major federal initiatives. First, a new national stormwater regulation, which is currently being developed by the US EPA and which is proposed to include a special Chesapeake Bay section. And second, the Chesapeake Bay Total Maximum Daily Load, or TMDL, which is also being developed by the EPA and by the Bay states. The next sound clip comes from Kurt Stevenson, a professor in the Virginia Tech Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, who discussed the benefits, costs, and uncertainties of stormwater economics in urban settings. In this excerpt, Dr. Stevenson suggests a way of thinking about how society chooses where and how much to invest in stormwater management.
Technical feasibility about what's achievable, economic rationale about what's it going to cost to keep pushing and pushing and pushing for higher levels of those in-stream conditions. and those water quality outcomes at a watershed level versus a site-by-site level, that you might arrive at the notion that it might be okay to have differential impacts across the landscape. It might be good to have an impacted watershed here in order to have higher water quality someplace else. And on the whole, in terms of what's being left out of the watershed, you might be better off. The watershed approach means assessing things in your watershed, identifying critical areas, things that you want to protect, things that are less important, looking at competing social goals, and then figuring out where you want to put your resources. I think this is consistent with that notion of these differential impacts, and I think that's okay, at least from an economist's perspective.
The symposium's next speaker was Thomas Schuler, coordinator of the Chesapeake Stormwater Network, who discussed stormwater nutrient accounting and economics in the Bay watershed. In this excerpt from his conclusion, Dr. Schuler summarizes what he sees as the difficult but solvable challenges of Bay Area stormwater issues.
We are in an era of major management uncertainty. We do have a lot of good technical information that we can collect and assemble and agree on to make this next round of decisions. And I think the biggest challenge in the Chesapeake Bay watershed is to come up with, if you will, almost a professional society of people that the scientists and managers who want to really take this seriously, work on the numbers, and get away from the debate to working on some of the solutions. It is a big problem. There are some big cost numbers involved, but I'll just conclude by saying that the sooner you get into the accounting and give yourself flexibility to look at things like stream restoration, fertilizer reductions, et cetera, you'll be closer to coming up with not only a more cost-effective approach, but something that actually makes a meaningful difference in your home streams as well as the Chesapeake Bay watershed.
The next comment comes from Robert Rosine, director of the University of New Hampshire Stormwater Center, who discussed the possible economic benefits of low-impact development, or LID. In this excerpt, Dr. Rosine discusses how using porous paving materials helped lead to overall cost savings on a residential project in New Hampshire by serving both transportation and stormwater functions.
So in this case, a lot of the savings were all due to cost avoidance. We avoided the use of about 1,600 feet of curbing, almost 800 feet of pipe, catch basins, detention basins, outlet control structures, and less land clearing. And when you look at the bottom line on this, there was about a 6.2% savings in this. So when you look at the actual unit cost, where the savings are, you always hear, we can't use porous pavement because it costs more. And it's true, it does cost more. But what we got to look at what we're replacing. We're building a system that has dual functionality, both a transportation system and a stormwater management system. If you're building regular pavement, you now have to build pond or other type of stormwater management infrastructure. So the savings here were there was less land clearing, less erosion control, less drainage infrastructure. There was indeed more higher costs for roadways and driveways. There was a cost for savings in curbing because it was all done sheet flow. Or actually, there wasn't a sheet flow because it's all porous. Less permanent erosion control measures, and then brings us to a bottom line of about maybe $50,000 savings. Now, the challenge on this project was that the designer was not the same as the builder, so that there needed to be good engineering oversight. So part of the successful implementation on projects is going to be, that's a whole lot more than the design. It's the design, it's the oversight during the construction to make sure that it's actually built as it said it was going to be built, and then there's going to be something with respect to long-term maintenance.
Our last sound clip is from Glenn Moglen, a professor in the Virginia Tech Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, who discussed a stormwater mapping tool and the difficulties of measuring the percentage of impervious surface in a watershed. In this excerpt from his summary, Dr. Moglen cautions about over-reliance on policies based on a specific threshold percentage of impervious surface. In the excerpt, the abbreviation NLCD refers to the National Land Cover Database, a nationwide inventory based on aerial and satellite images.
In summary, there's a lot of evidence that things get worse as the imperviousness goes up, but how do we measure this stuff? What data do we use? Do we believe the NLCD data? It's not going to catch the low end very well. And then where do we measure? Do we measure just at the outlet of our watershed? Because remember, every point in along a stream is the outlet of some watershed. So it's I would argue that we don't measure just at a single point, or at least the measurement inside, the measurement of a large watershed is not necessarily indicative of everything that's going on inside the watershed. And I haven't said it as loudly as I should have, but these policies that have this threshold mentality are basically promoting development right up to the razor edge of that of whatever that threshold is. And if we're wrong about that razor edge, we've blown it anyway. We have to first acknowledge there's no easy answer. The 10% threshold is very beguiling, and it's tempting to adopt it, to feel like if you're under some threshold, then all is well. But I don't think that's a good way to go. But I think we should understand basically where did that policy come from, understand that the data that informed that policy had some uncertainty itself in it. And so I think we should be very cautious about the adoption of any threshold.
About 200 people attended the Water Center's Stormwater Symposium, a clear sign of the high level of interest and concern about what happens to the water when it rains. Now it's time for our Water Sounds and Music segment. This week, we feature another mystery sound. Have a listen for about 20 seconds and see if you can identify the bird making several different kinds of calls. And here's a hint. If you knew all these calls, you would be an expert. If you guessed a wood duck, you're right. The two loud calls were female courtship sounds, the whistling in the background was a male, and the softer sound at the end was a female searching for a nest site. The wood duck is a common inhabitant of forested streams, lakes, and wetlands in Virginia and much of North America, nesting in tree cavities or in boxes placed to enhance habitat. Thanks to Lang Elliott of Nature Sound Studio for providing this recording. Now we look ahead to some upcoming water meetings and other events. First, in government policy and regulatory meetings occurring between November 4th and November 10th. On November 9th, the Virginia Scenic River Advisory Board meets in Richmond. For more information, phone Lynn Crump at 804-786-5054. And also on November 9th in Richmond, the U.S. EPA is holding a listening session and an environmental justice discussion on the Chesapeake Bay aspects of its proposed new national stormwater regulation. For more information, phone Rachel Herbert at 202-564-2649. Finally, in educational and recreational events, from November 14th to 17th at the Inner Harbor in Baltimore, Maryland, the American Society of Agricultural and Biological Engineers is holding TMDL 2010, Watershed Management to Improve Water Quality. Key organizers of the symposium are from the Virginia Tech Department of Biological Systems Engineering. For more information, phone Sharon McKnight at 269-932-7033. And that's it for this week's edition. Virginia Water Radio is a product of the Virginia Water Resources Research Center, which is solely responsible for the show's content. Production and show notes were done by Patrick Fay. Recording assistance was provided by University Relations at Virginia Tech. If you need more information about anything mentioned this week, call us at 540-231-5463 or visit our website at www.virginiawaterradio.org. For Virginia Water Radio, this is Alan Raflow, thanking you for listening and wishing you health, wisdom, and good water.